Not mincing words, an aide to Chris Christie says New Jersey's governor lied about Bridgegate. Christie denies the accusation. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Helping us to separate the wheat from the chaff, Matt Katz, WNYC reporter and author of American Governor, Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption. Matt, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight to help us make sense of Chris Christie.
Oh, for sure.
And Bridgegate, and we are fast coming up on the 3-year anniversary of the scheme. First, take a moment and take us back to Fort Lee for a quick review.
Sure. September 2013, and operatives who worked for Governor Christie at the Port Authority and in his office decided to punish the mayor of Fort Lee because the mayor did not endorse Christie's reelection by closing a lane to the George Washington Bridge, and that caused this 5-day traffic jam in Fort Lee, which is at the foot of the bridge, and it was meant to retaliate against the mayor. And now we have federal charges that were filed last year in the case, and two of his former appointees will stand trial next month, and a third pleaded guilty and will be testifying for the government.
Now, the allegations about lying refer to a news conference at the end of the year 2013.
That's right. This is when we still weren't sure what exactly happened. It was before the smoking gun in the case came out, which was the email that said time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee. That smoking gun is what triggered the federal investigation. Well, a month before that, Christie has this press conference, and we're asking him about this controversy because it had really started to bubble up. And we asked him specifically, were there any political retribution activities happening in your office by your senior staff? And he said, absolutely not. I've made it clear to everyone on my senior staff that they need to come forward if they had any knowledge, and they assured me that they don't. But while he was saying that, according to text messages that we just got today because of a court filing, one of his aides is writing to a campaign official who worked on his reelection campaign, and she's saying, are you listening? He just flat out lied about senior staff and campaign manager Bill Stepien not being involved. And then the other employee responds, Gov is doing fine, holding his own. And this woman, Christina Renna, replies, yes, but he lied. So that's a big indication that there was some sort of cover-up happening within the administration, and that many people, or at least some people at all levels, thought that the governor was involved, at least in that cover-up.
Now, this woman, Christina Renna, is new to those who don't know all the nuances. You cited Bill Stepien, Bill Baroni, and, of course, Bridget Ann Kelly. And I believe Renna worked for Kelly.
Yeah, that's right. She worked directly under Kelly. She was in charge of dealing with local mayors. And she actually had testified before the legislature's investigative committee into Bridgegate back last year. And she never brought this up. She never had alleged that she thought the governor was lying as part of the cover-up. So we reached out to her today, and her lawyer said she's not going to say anything more about this until next month, when she will be testifying on behalf of the prosecution in the Bridgegate trial.
And by way of response, the governor apparently said today that the allegation was made when Renna was not under oath.
Right. That was one of his responses. He also called the reporter stupid. He was doing a 4-hour morning show gig on sports radio WFAN in New York, which he's been doing a lot of recently. And he got off the air, and there were a bunch of reporters who were there to meet him because this had just broken while he was on the air. And they did not ask him about it while he was on the radio. So the reporters came and greeted him, and he seemed a little bothered. And he said that, well, it's not true. I had nothing to do with this. There's nothing new here. And she wasn't under oath when she sent this text message. So it's insignificant.
Give us a timetable. What's apt to happen next?
So we got the trial coming up in the second week in September. And this is really interesting because, as we saw with this piece of evidence, this is evidence that will be poured over in the courtroom, and there's going to be more documents like this. And it'll be very interesting to see if any of this sheds light on the outstanding questions in the Bridgegate affair. And those questions are, what did Chris Christie know from the time the lanes closed until the time we found out that the lanes were closed due to political retribution? Across those 4 months, Chris Christie was telling us it was just a traffic study, and there was nothing to see there. We're gonna find out a little bit more about that, I expect, in this trial when we see all of this evidence and we see a who's who of political power players in New Jersey come to Newark, the federal court, to testify.
And I expect we'll be relying on you again in the future to help us make sense of all of this. Thanks, Matt.
Whatever you need, Dave. Thanks.
WNYC reporter Matt Katz. In other news today, Republican U.S. Senator Pat Toomey accuses his Democratic opponent Katie McGinty of supporting a policy of protecting immigrants in the country illegally from federal authorities. Toomey says those policies put a man on the street who's now accused of raping a 13-year-old girl. Details from WHYY's Dave Davies.
Philadelphia is a so-called sanctuary city, meaning it doesn't routinely turn immigrants in the country illegally over to federal authorities. City policy does call for handing people over when immigration authorities present a judicial warrant and that person was convicted of a serious violent felony. Toomey says that policy led to the release of Ramon Aguirre Ochoa. He returned to the U.S. after being deported and was arrested on a domestic abuse charge. When the charges were dropped, despite an immigration authority's detainer request, Philadelphia police released him. After they let him go, he allegedly raped a 13-year-old. Toomey says many Republicans and Democrats want the city to change its approach.
But my opponent, Katie McGinty, refuses to join the bipartisan chorus to end this policy, which just shows how extreme she is.
Spokesman Sean Coit says McGinty has always said sanctuary cities are not the answer.
She wrote a public letter to the mayor saying, I'm concerned. I want to make sure that if there are dangerous criminals, that Philadelphia law enforcement is working with federal law enforcement.
Toomey says the letter is McGinty's way of avoiding taking a clear stand that the city needs to change its policy. Asked about the release of the man now accused of rape, a city spokeswoman says if immigration authorities had obtained an arrest warrant for Aguirre Ochoa based on his having been deported before, Philadelphia would have handed him over since it honors all arrest warrants. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
In Pennsylvania, attempts to change education policies or practices are often long, drawn-out slogs. What would it take to revolutionize the entire system to compete with the top school systems in the world? As Keystone Crossroads' Kevin McCoy reports, a new study urges lawmakers to fast-track international best practices.
Late last year, Congress dissolved the standardized test-heavy No Child Left Behind law, and its replacement gives much more power to states. How exactly that power is wielded will be hotly debated in Harrisburg. A new report from the National Council of State Legislatures, a bipartisan think tank, suggests a clear path forward. Julie Bell is the group's program director for education policy. She wrote the report with 22 state lawmakers from across the country, evenly split between Democrats and Republicans.
What surprised me, and I think them the most, was the consensus that came on some very fundamental principles that have played out very differently in the states.
So what's the magic formula? Analyzing best international practices, the group found a few commonalities of success. These include making sure kids come to first grade ready to learn, and that could mean providing quality pre-K or giving families extra parental support. Leading nations also make sure that the students who need the most help are given the best teachers and the greatest resources, a far stretch from what often occurs in many states, including Pennsylvania. David Sekola, a Democratic state senator from Delaware, participated in the study group.
You look at the schools and the demographics of the kids, and then you look at the teachers. You will find high-income kids more likely to be exposed to National Board Certified teachers, more likely to be exposed to teachers with 20 years experience and a master's degree. You know, these are things that do make a difference.
The report also stresses the need to rethink the teaching profession. The most successful school systems have much more rigorous entrance criteria for educators, and in exchange, teachers earn higher salaries and exercise more autonomy. Teachers are coached and supported by peers and administrators, and students' standardized test scores do not factor into their performance evaluations, a practice recently implemented in Pennsylvania. Again, Julie Bell.
We did find absolutely none of the other top-performing countries set up an evaluation system for teachers that's based on those kinds of tests or test scores. None of them do it that way.
The report also says students need the option of a high-quality technical education that can still lead to college if students choose. Many U.S. education researchers are reluctant to put too much stock in international comparisons, as leading nations tend to be small and culturally homogeneous. Bell believes that could be a short-sighted view.
Take a look and see what they've done and learn a little bit about it and find what makes sense for each state, because we're not making progress now. So something's got to change.
The group is planning a follow-up report to dig deeper into how leading countries turn the political wheels necessary to implement their reforms. Kevin McCrory, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY is the lead station. Still ahead this evening, we'll remember legendary Philadelphia television personality, Captain Noah.
From cowboys to police people, fire people, zoo people, circus people, I mean, he had guests that appealed.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. While Americans' understanding of concepts like sexuality and gender have become more nuanced in recent decades, members of the LGBT community are still questioned about their identity on a daily basis. Otter Jung Allen is a 16-year-old poet, artist, and self-proclaimed gender bender from West Philadelphia who holds the title of Philadelphia Youth Poet Laureate. They offer this poem titled A Lesson in Trans Joy.
1. Trans pain is currently a certainty. 2. Trans beauty is currently an inevitability. 3. When I'm asked about my genitals on a daily basis, it's not my fault when I start getting creative with my answers. Honestly, I should just start telling everyone there's a black hole there, because I could say anything and some theorist would still find a way to prove it doesn't exist. 4. Teenage trans boys look like tiny children for a reason. 3 words. Movie. Ticket. Discount. And you might ask, well, is looking like a newborn really worth it just to get a few dollars off of them? Yes. Straight out of Compton, you're damn right it is. 5. At some point, trans people can't really do much else to piss off the family. I mean, I've literally named myself after a semi-aquatic mammal. In their eyes, I've kinda hit the ceiling for nonsense. If I burn the house down, they'd just be like, as long as you don't ask for any more button-down shirts, we're good. 6. Being trans is being on the best game show in the world. How far can I go before my grandma stops buying it? 1 round for each invasive question, and grand prize is watching the look on her face when I say, actually, grandma, they botched the surgery, and now I have a cactus down there. 7. We know we're different. Not everyone has fluctuation in their back pocket like we do. Not everyone moves like unanswered questions. I mean, look at us. Allow me to recognize how fine we are. I mean, look at our baby faces, or our Adam's apples and painted nails, or our two-hair beards. They can't stop debating us, because our beauty is miles past thesis, and the rest are running to catch up and hypothesize. They keep us on the streets, because our hands are too pure for homes washed in hand-me-down hate. They don't believe us. We don't need them to. Mortals never do seem to believe it when they see magic anyway. 8. We pack our pride like armor, like bigots pack ammunition, like phoenixes pack resurrection. We have too much flight in us to entertain ideas so earthbound. We are a chorus of our own making. Bodies and voices with bliss in the background. Don't they know they cannot kill a people who have built themselves? We do not burn like bones do. We are rebirth remixed. Our ashes glitter. The smoke is singing. Even in death or dysphoria, we pick fights with our ghosts. 9. Let them come at us. then will never catch us off guard when we are this trained in transition. We've got endurance like oceans and bodies like water, all fluidity and freedom. We flood towns with this. Why else would they call us a trend unless we were in high demand? Our self-love is nothing short of commodity, of relic, of beaten down and glowed up, of overwhelmed and overwhelming as a consequence. There is nothing more holy than correcting how they talk about your halo. There is nothing more royal than shedding old titles to find new ones that sound more regal. Look at us reign, all us insecure and estranged kids, and still never be cis to save my life, kids. Look at us be, not in spite of ourselves, but because of ourselves. Not in death's face, but behind his back, so we don't give him the satisfaction. 10. This has been your lesson in trans joy.
Otto Jung Allen is the 2016 Philadelphia Youth Poet Laureate. You can read A Lesson in Trans Joy and other commentaries at newsworks.org. The 6th annual Gay Fest gets underway Friday. Joining me with a preview is Rich Rubin, producing artist director at Quince Productions. Rich, welcome to Newsworks tonight.
Thank you very much.
And Quince has been putting on these fests since the inception 6 years ago. How has it evolved in that time?
Well, let me tell you a little bit about the beginning of the festival. There had always been in Philadelphia, you're probably aware, the PGLTF, the Philadelphia Gay and Lesbian Theater Festival. When we found that that was no longer happening, I called my 4 board members and said, what do you think about this? They said, let's move forward with it. So in 2011, we did the first Gay Fest, which was at the Little Shubin Theater on Bainbridge Street, which is unfortunately no more. 4 plays crammed into that tiny space, and it went over really well. So we said, let's keep going with this. It sort of expanded through the years. The second year, all 4 plays were at Plays and Players. Then we started using 2 theaters. And then we started adding all kinds of special events. It's always been 4 main stage plays. Now there are all kinds of other special things surrounding those 4 main stage plays.
Music, dance, performance arts, spoken word.
All the above.
Tell us about this unusual business model. It's pay what you can.
Well, we decided to do that on our previews. We brazenly stole it from another theater company in town. And previews are always an iffy proposition. Everybody wants to come to opening night. With us, the preview is not much different. It's not going to be like half the lights aren't hung or something like that. It's going to be essentially the opening of the show.
And so you are directing 2 of the performances. Let's take them in turn. A play called Harbor.
Yes. Harbor is a comedy about these 2 pretty upscale gay married men who live in a fancy house on Sag Harbor, and their life is going along just swimmingly until
Sag Harbor in the Hamptons.
Yes. Mm-hmm. One day, who should arrive out of the blue but the sister of one of the men who lives with her 15-year-old daughter in a van, and she and the daughter arrive out of the blue. And while it's very funny, it considers some important issues of, in this age where the ability to marry is a given, how does that affect people? Do these 2 gay men who are married now necessarily need to follow the model of what traditional marriage has always been? So it's a play that talks a lot about family, about what does it mean now that we have marriage and how do we move forward? But above all, it's a comedy.
So let's move on to the second play entitled My Favorite Husband.
That's a play by Andrew Marvel, a New York playwright. It's very, very funny. It's about this man who has an ex-lover he's remained friendly with over many, many years, who is about to get married to a rising Republican assemblyman in New Jersey. And in the mythical world of this play, maybe this requires a little suspension of disbelief, the entire GOP, all of the Republican bigwigs, are turning out to the wedding to show their support. And this so enrages Mark that his ex-lover is doing this, that he decides to crash the wedding in drag.
So here we are speaking just days before the onset, and you seem rather cool, calm, and collected. Is it because you're a veteran of putting these kinds of events together?
The nuts and bolts of the festival are pretty well locked down, but it's sort of a matter of getting used to the fact that there's going to be a daily crisis and recognizing it, and oh, this is today's crisis. I can freak out about it or I can try to solve it.
Well, good luck with the upcoming festival. Thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you so much.
Rich Rubin, producing artistic director at Quince Productions. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. A legendary Philadelphia television personality died yesterday. Carter Merbrier, also known as Captain Noah, was 90 years old. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that he entertained and informed children for 27 years.
In the mid-1960s, the Philadelphia Council of Churches sent word out to its members that they had some TV airtime to fill, and did anyone have ideas for a show? Carter Merbrier, a Lutheran minister from North Philadelphia, was the only one who responded.
Send your pictures to dear old Captain Noah.
Merbrier and his wife Pat created Captain Noah's Magical Ark, a live, one-hour kids show that ran every weekday morning from 1967 through 1994. It was a goofy mix of puppets, cartoons, history lessons, and guest appearances from the likes of Elvis Presley, John Lennon, Jon Stewart, and the Philly Fanatic. In fact, the sports mascot made its public debut on the Magical Ark. The show's longtime producer, Luke Klein, says the captain had wonderful ways of communicating to children.
And he had a wonderful way of having guests that also appealed. He had guests every show. There was somebody, from cowboys to police people, fire people, zoo people, circus people. I mean, he had guests that appealed.
Merbrier never forgot his religious vocation. While a TV host, he used the show to share moral lessons with generations of children. In a 2013 interview, the captain said he welcomed basketball player Charles Barkley on the show many times, even though Barkley famously resisted being a role model.
Somebody wrote, "Can't you find anybody better than Charles Barkley?" I said, "Not that would talk to children about falling down and getting up and starting over again. We tried to get Jesus of Nazareth, but he wasn't available."
Captain Noah's Magical Ark went off the air in 1994. In 2011, Merbrier's wife, Pat, died. Luke Klein says the last 5 years had been rough on Merbrier, with declining health and depression. He was reclusive during his final years. After a long and otherwise joyful life spent entertaining and teaching children, Klein says the captain was ready to go.
Red and yellow and pink and
I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Purple and orange.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Binyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader, with additional production today from Ty Johnson. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.
Oh, look, the rain stopped. And there's the rainbow.